Thank you all for coming out. This is great to see, because we walked in and there are maybe like eight of you, and then we looked up and it's whoa. Hi, my name is James Bennett II. I'm an arts and culture reporter at GBH, as well as a co-host of 89.7's afternoon culture show, aptly titled The Culture Show. And we're here in Old South Church for this panel discussion called Memoir, Creating Identity. And it's a really small title, three words, and there's so many different ways to slice that up. And we have limited time, and there are a lot of you, so we might not be able to distribute the whole pie, but we hope you leave with some, you know, nice chunks. And so I just want to introduce the authors that we'll be, you know, talking to today. And I'm going to start with An Unlin Cheng, as a professor of English and affiliated faculty in the program in American Studies, the program in Gender and Sexuality Studies, and the Committee on Film Studies at Princeton University. Her published work includes Second Skin, Josephine Baker, and the Modern Surface, Ornamentalism, and the Melancholy of Race, Psychoanalysis, Assimilation, Hidden Grief. Her latest, which is what we're going to be talking about today, Ordinary Disasters, How I Stopped Being a Model Minority, is a memoir presented as a series of essays and letters in which she grapples with aesthetics, fetishization, family, and the immigrant experience in the United States. Gerald Walker is a professor of creative writing and African-American literature at Emerson University here in Boston. He's received fellowships from, among others, the Guggenheim Foundation of the National Endowment of the Arts. You can catch his writing in platforms and publications, including the Harvard Review, the New York Times, Mother Jones, and Creative Nonfiction. He's the author of National Book Award finalist How to Make a Slave, and his latest collection is Magically Black. And then finally, Oliver Radcliffe right here is part of the new wave of transgender writers unafraid to address the complex nuances of transition, examining the places where gender identity, sexual orientation, feminist allegiance, social class, and family history overlap. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Electric Literature, the Gay and Lesbian Review, Print Magazine, and Them. His monograph, Adult Human Male, was published by Unbound Edition in 2023. And the memoir we're discussing today is Frighten the Horses, out now with Roxane Gay Books. So we're here to discuss this trio of memoir, or there's a lot of different ways to talk about it, memoir, personal essay. And the thing that really caught me is that they're so distinct in their narrative style, or the style of their presentation. And I want to just kind of dive into that, right, the way we tell that story. And we can't do that until, you know, we hear what these styles sound like. So I would just ask each of you if you would so kindly read an excerpt from these books that you have recently written. We can go down the line, or
we'll start with Gerald.
Well, yeah, let's boom, boom, boom. Gerald, let's go.
Set at the wrong end.
All right.
Okay, this is from my essay entitled "It's Hard Out Here for a Memoirist." For longtime memoirists, there invariably comes a point when the material runs a little thin, forcing them to make use of their most guarded secrets and transgressions, as I shall do here. To begin, then, once many years ago when I was 17, and for a very brief period, merely 7 weeks to be exact, I was a pimp. I am deeply ashamed of this. It helps to remind myself that what primarily appealed to me about the profession were the fedoras and Cadillacs, as well as the possibility of having many girlfriends, or at least one. And I especially liked the idea of not working, or rather, as my older brother Tim used to say, not working for the man. Tim had worked for the man once and strongly advised against it. There were much better options, he said, but the ones he recommended, alas, were not those. He would admit to having steered me wrong, I believe, if he could. Tragically, he succumbed to some of the very vices he taught me, his heart overtaxed by the strains of street life and probably regret, giving out at age 47. The manner of his premature death could not have been predicted by anyone who knew him in his youth. Honor student, religious to the point of fanaticism, loving, witty, and kind. And then, overnight it seemed, he was running hustles and cons before dropping out of college and quitting his part-time job as an accountant. But I do wonder sometimes if it was not regret that played a role in his death. Maybe it was the blame he harbored for whomever had led him astray. The idea to live outside the law, after all, could not have come to him on its own any more than it had come to me. How it had come to me was this. I was engrossed in one of my sister's romance novels, fretting over the heroine's decision to elope with her fiancé's father, when Tim, 19, snatched a book from my hands. He had done this before. Romance novels, he suspected, were improper reading material for 14-year-old black boys, and my friends had proved his suspicion to be true. They had recently discovered one on my dresser, my sister's feathered bookmark fanning from its pages, and the ensuing teasing was merciless. I never brought the novels to my bedroom again. Instead, I hid them in the garage where, every day after school, I would unearth one and sit on the blanket behind our parents' defunct station wagon to enter into faraway worlds of love and desire, always alert to the sound of approaching footsteps, which, on the day in question, escaped me. "Here," Tim said, dropping a book onto my lap, "read this." I looked at the title. It was Pimp, The Story of My Life by Iceberg Slim. I returned it to him a few days later. "So what do you think?" he asked. "I think," I said, "I should not have read that." He disagreed. There was another author, he added, with whom I should also be familiar. His name was Donald Goines. Goines had been a pimp too. He had also been a bootlegger, thief, addict, and inmate. So he had plenty of material at his disposal, enough to fill 16 novels. I should not have read those either. And he probably should not have written them. It was believed that a number of the people on whom he had based his characters objected to their portrayal and rendered the harshest of critiques. Goines's body, along with his girlfriend's, was found in his apartment, full of bullets. Some memoirist, in an effort to juice up the narrative tension, would exaggerate the gulf between their experiences and those of Donald Goines and Iceberg Slim. But the fact of the matter is, if my avatar were an animal, it would have been, for the first 11 years of my life, Bambi. I knew nothing beyond church, Marvel Comics, The Three Stooges, and when I turned 12, but only in strict obedience to the demands of nature, the lingerie section of the Sears catalog. Did I press my mouth upon the models' tiny faces? Did I rub my fingers along their miniature bosoms? Did I hold those pages up to the light, hoping to discover the mysteries beyond the discounted silks and satins? I did. Quite often. Obsessively, some might say. This, however, was hardly preparation for entering the worlds of Donald Goines and Iceberg Slim. Although the worlds of Donald Goines and Iceberg Slim, in retrospect, would have been good preparation for entering the backyard of Rachel Jones. Rachel was a new girl on our block. Rumor had it she liked being felt up. I provided a detailed account of my confirmation of this rumor in my second memoir. Suffice it here for the reader to picture Bambi getting his first whiff of smoke as the forest burns. For I, like that delicate creature, after willing my trembling 14-year-old self beneath the raised deck, where this 17-year-old had lured me, was suddenly paralyzed with fear and indecision. Rachel relieved me of both by guiding my hands. And yet that did not prepare me for the worlds of Donald Goines and Iceberg Slim either. Nor did the dirty magazine a classmate had pilfered from his father's stash and brought to school, or the one I had discovered while rummaging through my sister's bedroom, and certainly not her romance novels, although the one about the pilot and three stewardesses was helpful. In combination, however, these items awakened in me a strong curiosity about manhood and how I might enter into it. I read the books Tim gave me then, partially in search of answers. More often, I found questions.
Thank you. So this is a book of a sort of a cross between memoir and social analysis, and it covers various wide range of topics from American Girl dolls to Joan Didion's packing tips to sushi restaurants in Atlanta to faculty politics. That's what my tenure is for. Affirmative action, race, aging, cancer. So it's kind of, you know, over the place. What I thought I would do today is read two pages from an essay called The Fictions and Frictions of Interracial Love. And it's about my marriage, about my interracial marriage. What does it mean anyway for me to say that race interferes in our marriage? To recognize this is to say everything and nothing. I'm a scholar of race for over 30 years, but it's still challenging to parse out how race lives in the pockets of everyday intimacies. I call his family WASPy, but that's an inaccurate shorthand for the peculiar blend of public and private histories, their manifestations and disguises. My husband grew up hardly ever seeing blacks, Asians, or foreigners, unless, of course, you're talking about his own mother, a Latvian refugee who came to the US at age 11, right around the same time I came to the States. Unlike the relatively cushioned way I came to the States, my mother-in-law's family had wandered ruthlessly across Europe for several years in the wake of World War II, fleeing German and then Russian armies before making their way to the U.S. under the refugee sponsorship program. Her family, including her as a child, did field work for 3 years on a Virginia farm to repay their passage. At age 82 now, my mother-in-law is independent, fiercely loyal, and capable of making everything by hand, from curtain to car seat upholstery. She thinks of America as a land of salvation and is susceptible to conservative fear-mongering about immigrant hordes at the border. She doesn't see the dissonance. My family, too, practiced its own versions of forgetfulness. My father came to America and didn't look back. He never talked about his childhood and did not own a single photo of himself as a child. I learned from my mother that his father died almost the same time as his birth and that his mother, a young indigent widow, swayed by some fortune teller, believed that her infant son was the cause of her husband's death. When the latter really did die from something that penicillin would have prevented. I think that was why my father became a doctor against his mother's wishes. She didn't want to have to find means for paying for it. Once in America, my father dutifully sent money from home to his mother every month for more than two decades in envelopes into which his wife, my mother, would insert letters on his behalf. He never set foot in Taiwan again. After my last grandparent died, I never went back to Taiwan either. I mastered English, while my Mandarin and Taiwanese deteriorated to an embarrassing degree. Neither of my children speak Chinese, and neither have ever visited Taiwan with me. My fault. My success as an assimilated person depended a great deal on forms of forgetting that I have only now started to come to see. I said I was haunted by history, which is not the same as living consciously with it. History has been a kind of silent creek running in the background of my daily life. Only recently has that path risen to meet me like a tidal wave. Thank you.
I'm actually gonna read a very short piece, which is just a page and a half, right at the very beginning of my memoir. Leaving Juan with a fist bump, I drove through town and out into the suburbs, where I shared a house with my four teenage children. In the kitchen, Lily was making scones, covering the counter with a mess of flour and pastry. I opened the back door and let the dogs out into the backyard, where my younger son Alfie was playing volleyball with some friends, and then yelled upstairs to Fred, my eldest, to check he was out of the shower. Lily's twin sister, Rose, was in the living room, lounging on the sofa, chatting on her phone. "Nice haircut," she mouthed as I walked past. I just had time to change into a fresh pair of jeans and a clean T-shirt when there was a knock on the front door. I opened it to find a tall, lanky teenager standing on the porch next to a middle-aged man wearing a polo shirt and a baseball cap. "Fred, Nathan's here," I yelled up the stairs as the teenager loped past me. "Hi, I'm Oliver," I said to the man on the porch. Adrian, Nathan's dad, he said, shaking my outstretched hand. What time should I pick him up? I'll get Fred's father to text you. He's taking them out for pizza. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were Fred's dad. I am. So you're his stepdad? He peered past me, searching for a wife. No, I'm his biological father. Charles is Fred's other dad. He lives downtown. Oh, I see, Adrian said, clearly not seeing at all. We're divorced, I offered kindly. Ah, okay. I watched the possibility that I might be gay dawn on Adrian's face. At that moment, Charles arrived. Charles, this is Adrian, I said. Adrian hesitated briefly and then extended his hand in response to Charles's greeting while he tried to make this whole equation work. From the suburban perspective, where stereotypes prevailed, nobody could look much less gay than Charles. For a moment, I almost felt sorry for Adrian. The old me would have gone out of my way to make him feel comfortable, but the old me was gone. Adrian had almost arrived back at the safety of his car when Fred came charging down the stairs, Nathan at his heels. See you later, Mum, he said as he headed down the front path. I caught a glimpse of Adrian's bewildered expression as he closed his car door, his fingers fumbling with the ignition key. My mouth twitched. I should probably have put the poor man out of his misery, but I really didn't have the time.
Thank you. Thank you all. I'm looking at my notes, and I feel that we've been thrust into a choose-your-own-adventure because there are so many different ways this conversation could play out. But I think I do want to kind of take it back top, right, and dive right in to the stylistic differences that we heard about how you kind of create the narrative of self. And so, to me, right, like, we have this extremely detailed, you know, chronological journey. We have these, you know, essays that blend the personal and the political. And then we have, like, these deeply humorous but cutting, you know, vignettes, right, of your life, Gerald, that I, you know, appreciate so much. And so I'm just curious to know, as you write about the self, what makes you think, yeah, this is the best way to convey the story of me to you, the reader? How do you choose that?
Are you going to ask one of us, or should we just jump in?
You can jump in, yeah.
I will
We're
jump
popcorn
in.
Popcorn,
yeah.
Okay,
I'm going to pop right out of that one. I made a very conscious decision when I started writing this memoir that I wanted to write something really relatable and humorous, because trans issues are so often talked about in this kind of dour, depressing way. And when you see it covered in the press, it's always like a child in profile gazing out of a window. And it's all, you know, couched in this kind of feeling of kind of misery. And, you know, that's not what being trans is. Trans is actually, firstly, it's really joyful and fun. But also, it's funny. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's stupid. You get yourselves into the most ridiculous situations you can imagine. And, you know, yes, there's the heavy stuff, there's loss, there's pain, there's prejudice and all the rest of it. But I really wanted to bring to life the reality of how ludicrous it is to transition, and the responses of the people around you, and the situations you find. So I really wanted to write. I took all the politics out of this book completely, and I just wrote about the personal experience with as much humor as I could.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, because I feel, Anne, you put the politics completely, you know, into this book and infuse that with your personal experiences. What was that thought process like?
There are people in here who might have been students of mine. They know that they're not allowed to use, when students write for me, they're not allowed to use the word identity. So they have to think about what that word actually means for them. And so part of this book is really trying to be figuring out what's underneath when we say a racial identity or a gender identity, and how it's lived out in everyday experience. But my goal was actually very simple. I thought to myself, what am I? I made a list of what I'm afraid to write about. Then I wrote about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Gerald, right? Like, you're, I guess, the seasoned memoirist, as you actually said at the top of the essay that you read to us. Is there a certain advantage that comes with giving us a peek into the life, you know, as essay versus in the beginning, this is who I am and how I came to be?
Well, there's a disadvantage. I'll start with that. I just read an excerpt about me saying I was a pimp. I was not a pimp. I gave a reading a few days ago, and I read a similar excerpt, and I could see people in the audience just looking at me as I did that. It's satire, and I'm serving two masters in that particular essay. I'm telling my story from the perspective of a 14-year-old on the south side of Chicago in the 70s who's being raised by certain images that are prevalent in the community, and one at that time was blaxploitation films. We spent a lot of our youth watching things like Superfly and Foxy Brown and all of these things, and we wanted to emulate them. Everybody who was a 14-year-old kid in that community thought he was a pimp. And we walked around saying, hey, what's going on, pimp? Nothing, pimp, how you doing? And that was that community. So from my childhood perspective, I really thought that I was living a certain life that I wasn't living. But as a writer, what I wanted to do with the piece was to kind of poke fun at memoirists and personal essayists. How the more we write about ourselves, the less and less material we have. It's finite material, unless you're going to go out every day and commit some crime so you can have some material, which I've considered. But you have to, if you are going to write about yourself constantly, you may be tempted to exaggerate now and then and to see how you can embellish your stories and what you can get away with. And I have seen many memoirists take something that is most definitely a molehill and make it into a mountain. So I'm kind of poking at fun at that in this essay.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It reminds me of a thing that my sister told me once when she was, you know, criticizing, I think, like Jay-Z circa 2008. And she's like, everything that he's written is about his own personal experience, but it's caught up and he's kind of out of things to rap about now. And we're in this awkward position. But, you know, in that essay, though, you do start off, right? And you're talking about how the memoirist is making use of these guarded secrets or whatever, you're taking us back to being 14 and whatnot. And so, you know, even though it is funny, even though you're making that kind of satirical punch, I am curious to hear the thoughts of all of you about what's it like to be so honest with yourself? Is it scary? That terrifies me to sit down, right, and explore even a section of myself that I haven't even had the chance to really look into, let alone do that for, you know, the reading benefits of others. What's that like?
Well, I have to say, for me, it was scary as an academic who wrote academic books for like most of my life. It's super scary, but also it was really exhilarating because I think that, you know, it's such a cliche, but it really is kind of a therapy. Like, you have to really reckon with yourself. And I don't assume that, you know, I don't assume that my life is interesting to other people, but I do think that if I could think about the ways in which these large categories I write about all the time as a scholar to really reckon with how they get lived out in my intimate everyday life. And it turns out I'm not so shy about, like, you know, saying things like that's private, like, you know, like my husband and I have fights, you know, or that I had cancer or something like that. But the thing that I noticed when I was writing this book was for the first time I had to worry about the ethics of writing, because it's not about me. It's when I'm exposing my loved ones, my husband, my children, my mother. And so I think that it was actually, I was less worried about my exposure and much more worried about the people around me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you must have similar.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, I did. But what's more interesting about this book is that I actually wrote myself into my transition. Mm-hmm. So I started writing this memoir. I was married to a man in a heterosexual marriage with four kids, and I came out as a lesbian. And it was while I identified as a lesbian for 7 years, and it was while I was identifying as a lesbian that I first started drafting this. And, you know, I talk about the humor as a very British thing, but the first drafts were just very shallow because it was just, I was just trying to be funny the whole time, and there was no depth. And when I started going into the depths, and I really had to dig down and figure out what was going on, I found that I was writing about my masculinity. And the more I wrote about it, the more I realized, there's more going on here than I was bargaining for. So I spent 5 years writing a manuscript that got scrapped, and I then started again as I started transitioning and wrote this new manuscript. So yeah, digging below the surface has consequences sometimes.
Oh yeah.
That's a good point. I was terrified of writing nonfiction when I first started writing. My MFA is in fiction writing. When I completed my degree, I wrote fiction for 15 years exclusively. And without the kind of success I was seeking, which is to say, publication. and then my wife suggested that I switch to nonfiction. And I said, My wife by then knew my life. I was raised in a pretty dangerous neighborhood, and I did some pretty bad things and stupid things in my youth. And I was hiding behind all of that in my fiction. I didn't really want to expose myself, to come out from behind the veil and present myself to the world. And she convinced me that I have nothing to be ashamed about when telling my story. I would only have to be ashamed if I really truly thought that I was different from people. But I'm not different from people. I'm like everyone else. And my stories, ultimately, considering from the vantage point of where I'm writing them as an academic, these are not stories of shame. These are stories of redemption. And that by putting your story on the page and saying, yes, I made this mistake. Yes, I made a wrong turn here. Yes, I had a very long detour during this. But I came out the other side. And in the process, I learned a few things that might be of value to some other people who are also in the middle of a detour, or who have just come out of one and trying to figure out what's next. How do I move forward? My work might be of some benefit to those people. And my wife encouraging me to do that was a large part of the motivation to make me say, here I am.
Yeah, I actually think that one thing I learned from literature is that the more specific, idiosyncratic, and real you get, the more specifically idiosyncratic you is actually where you touch other people the most. So you actually kind of have to go there,
yes,
in order to speak to people. Yeah, so.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate that framing, that it's only, you know, embarrassing or really vulnerable if you're the only one that's done it. But you're never the only one.
Right.
There's
yeah.
billions and billions of us. Oliver, you had touched on something that I wanted to lob to the group, actually. So you answered this, but I did want to know about kind of the process of discovery. And you had written something that I'm going to just quickly read. It's a short quote, so don't worry. But I do want to read this quote because it prompted this thought. And I know Ani had already said that your students can't use the word identity, but unfortunately there is no escaping. I also cleared it with staff, and we are allowed to swear in the house of the Lord this Saturday. But Oliver, you're right. You're talking to Henry, who is your therapist, correct? And you're explaining, you're coming out as lesbian. And so Henry says, you don't need to talk to Charles just yet. Take some time to come to terms with your own identity first, Henry said. You reply, but I don't even know what that means. I don't know what my identity is. Who am I meant to be? Everyone's always saying, just be yourself, which would be great advice if I had the faintest fucking clue what they meant. And so you've explained, right, how this was a, you know, you said you wrote yourself into transition while writing the early drafts of this memoir, but I'm also curious to know, with you, Gerald and Ann, like, did you have a process of new discovery writing these new books? These aren't the first times you've written, you know. You've been in the literary game for a while, so.
Yeah, it's definitely new for me, I mean, the whole thing was about discovery. I was writing to figure something out. I was going through health issues. The world I saw was getting sick too, with the pandemic and the anti-racism, the AAPI hate stuff going on. And all the stuff that used to help me survive these kind of disasters, like my work, my intellectual work, my sense of justice, my sense of self-mastery, all that stuff just like, it just fell, like none of it worked. I started writing to sort of really figure out some of these pressures in my life, and I don't think I solve, because a lot of the things I think I write about are very paradoxical. I don't think they're solvable, but for me anyway, I felt like, and I'm sure my panelist feels the same, for me, being able to articulate the problem itself is already a kind of blessing, to have a lucidity about what it is that all the different pressures that's bearing down on your life. The whole thing was very much a process, and I can write rewrite obsessively for a very long time, but I know I'm done with an essay when it feels like at the end that I've taken a rock from my heart and put it on a table. So the whole process of writing this book was me taking rocks out and putting it on a table. Yeah.
Yeah. And did you find anything new about yourself?
About myself? Always. I mean, if you do a personal essay or a memoir the way it should be done, if you're doing it correctly, it is by definition an act of discovery. You learn as you go. Many people make the mistake of thinking that essayists write essays to impart knowledge. But But essays write essays to learn things, and particularly about the self. I always learn something new about myself in the process of writing. I learn something new about the topics I'm writing about. And when I finish an essay, I know or have a good sense that it's gone well if I say, wow, I didn't know that during the course of writing it many times. And when I finish an essay, I'm usually surprised when I write the final sentence. I never know that the final sentence will be the final sentence till I write it. And then I back away and I say, that's the end. And what a journey that was. And I can go back and reread it. And again, marvel at the discoveries that the process gave to me during the process of actually writing the essay.
When I was revising, I was really unhappy with my early drafts. And when I was revising, I started doing some research, which maybe I should have done at the beginning, about what readers of memoir actually want to read. And I read this quote that just said it's direct access to the memoirist's soul. And I was like, oh, God.
That's easy.
Really? You know, and as a trans person who was not at that point out, I had spent 40 plus years meticulously covering that up with everything and everything, which is why when I'm in with my therapist and he says, who are you? And I'm like, I have literally no idea. And he says, you should start peeling everything off. And I'm like, what happens if I peel everything off and there's nothing there? I just disappear, because that's really how I felt. And I think it's how a lot of trans people feel, that underneath all these layers of what we're putting on to make ourselves seem socially acceptable, we have no idea what's inside. So that process alone of taking off the stuff that wasn't me was absolutely terrifying. And I think that was the most frightening part of the whole process. And then once I'd got to what was underneath, it's like, okay, guys, you can have it because I'm here now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it just occurred to me that we spent the better part of the last half hour talking about identity as it relates to the self. But I'm also curious about how it relates to the whole, to the group, to the communities that we find ourselves in. And again, short, I promise you're not here to listen to me. But Anya, you have this bit in the essay Affirmative Action where you're talking about, you know, your studies as an English major in undergrad. And you're coming right out of talking about how you didn't want to study, pursue an East Asian studies major because you used the phrase, you know, what I study myself seems self-involved and intellectually suspicious. But you follow that up with a series of questions, right? You say, but why did I think that? White students don't feel solipsistic or intellectually illegitimate when they study Shakespeare or James Joyce or when they major in American studies. I was, in fact, shaped by the cliches I thought I was eschewing. And not giving into stereotypes, I ended up denying large parts of myself. And what I didn't realize as a young person was that when I shielded away from East Asian studies, or American studies for that matter, I also foreclosed for myself fields of knowledge and communities that might have spoken to my young self's private, ongoing struggles with what it means to be American, Asian, and Asian American. And so I think where I want to head now is kind of discussing, you know, how you see, how you reconcile yourself, how you perceive yourself, identify as yourself, and how you exist within, you know, the communities that you've self-selected or that society puts you into. So if you wanna...
Well, I have to say, I spent most of my adult life feeling estranged. First, we were, you know, Taiwanese immigrants in Georgia in the 70s, and that was weird.
Great essay about that, too.
Yeah, there's a piece called Southern Chinese. Turns out they were actually Asians in the South, but it's complicated. Anyway, so I always felt like an immigrant, even after I started speaking only English, even after I started dreaming in English only. So I feel like there were all these categories that I didn't know my relation to American. And then, of course, growing up in Georgia, no one ever talks about Asian American. Like, I never even heard of that term until I was in, like, graduate school. And Princeton undergrad, no one talks about that either. I mean, there's East Asian studies, right? But there's no Asian American studies. So there are these categories that it took me years to sort of figure out my relationship to it. And I think that part of the problem is that when you are a person of color and you're racialized constantly by virtue of how you look, then you're always in this exile position, number one. And number two, you're always trying not to be something, right? Like, I was desperately trying not to be a stereotype. So that's why, I was an English major, I wasn't an EAS major, I wasn't going to be a doctor, I wasn't going to be a lawyer. So I actually thought of myself as this like anti-model minority for the longest time, until one day I woke up, not so long ago, and I realized, oh my God, I thought about the model minority mostly as an economic model, right? People who become lawyers and doctors. But actually, it's also a kind of social model. Right, and that in all the ways in which I was always striving to be, good, always striving to please people, always, in the ways in which I was trying to be this responsible, diligent person, I was actually totally the model minority that I deconstruct with my students in the classroom. So I think that, I feel like I'm constantly trying to figure out my relationship to a larger group, but now I've come to a point where I feel much more comfortable, I'm comfortable saying, I'm Asian American, not because I was born here, but because I work damn hard at Asian and Asian American and American history. So like, I feel like I own that category now. That's because I studied it, I come to learn it.
Yeah.
So I don't think I belong by
go ahead.
By origin. I belong by education.
This is interactive. Gerald, how do you bring yourself into community, your sense of self into a wider group?
In terms of my writing, or just
in terms of the self, right? We're just thinking about identity, and this you've been talking about that crafting the self identity and creating that narrative. Yeah.
Like Anna, I too had to learn what it meant to be a minority. I was raised in a white supremacist doomsday cult, and the cult taught that whites were superior and blacks were inferior. There were very few blacks in this cult, as you might imagine. but somehow, my parents were lucky enough to be among the few. And so we were taught that in addition to the world ending in 1975 and a few other things that didn't pan out, we were taught that whites were superior and blacks were inferior. And we also we could only socialize with people who were in the cult. So my understanding of black culture was based on what the racist founder of our cult taught. When the cult began to fall apart in the late 70s, when I was coming of age, I was 14, 15 years old, I had to figure out what to do now with my understanding of what blackness is. I had no real idea. I had to learn how to be black. One reason why I was so susceptible to the blaxploitation movies is because it seemed to provide some answers. Oh, that's what it means to be black. I also, from my community on the south side of Chicago, learned that being black meant selling dope. It meant committing petty crimes. It meant doing all these things. So I had to spend a great deal of my youth trying to figure out the definitions of blackness. And I accepted ones that were false and damaging for a long time, until I finally worked my way to a new definition of what blackness means. And it's largely based on the culture of heroism and resiliency that blacks created in response to their enslavement. That is the meaning of blackness. It is having hope that the future will get better. It is knowing that you have the strength to withstand whatever it is that is thrown at you, and understanding that for a group of people to survive hundreds of years of brutalization, you are by definition more than the sum of that brutalization. So once I started understanding, clap and vote.
Yes.
I don't want to say don't clap. You can clap. Once I understood that there was a positive way to define my being and my identity, it changed my whole view of how I would lead my life from that point forward. And it also informed my writing. So you will not read anything that I write and come away from my work with anything but a positive, hopeful, encouraging view of what it means to be a black person in America.
Yeah, yeah. And Oliver, I want to get, I'm sure we all want to hear your response should you have one, but I also am getting time cards, that's how it works. So I want to invite people, you see that mic right there in the center aisle, if people want to start queuing up to ask questions to these wonderful writers, I would invite you all to just hop on the mic. So back to you.
Well, so, I mean, my memoir is really almost entirely about trying to find community, because I also grew up in a cult, but it was the more socially sanctioned cult of white British upper-class society. but, you know, it was a white supremacist cult. Yeah. I mean, everybody was rich, white, and heterosexual. And it took me a really long time to break out of it, because I had to leave the country in order to do it, because the walls around this little social society that I grew up in were so high that we were really gaslit into believing that we had everything and we were privileged and we were fortunate, and why would we ever want to choose anything else? And, you know, from birth, for obvious reasons now, I felt incredibly uncomfortable there, and I didn't feel like I belonged, and I felt like, I always felt like an infiltrator or a spy, that I was going to be exposed, that people were going to, but I didn't know why. I was, you know, I was in full denial about both my sexual orientation and my gender identity. And when I finally came over to this country and I started coming out, my now ex-husband used emotional blackmail to keep me in the marriage and to keep me closeted for quite a substantial amount of time. And that was really the worst time, because I could see my people, like, there, and I couldn't get to them. And books were my salvation. I started reading the genderqueer and trans and queer writers, and it was like discovering the language that I had known from birth. It was like feeling like I'd been kidnapped at birth and brought up in this place where I was taught a foreign language, and now I had just found the language of my birth, because the way these people were talking felt so fluent and coherent to me. And it was the first time I realized, oh, I'm not on my own. These people do exist. And the thing about the trans experience is one trans person cannot represent the trans community, because it's so wide. The ways of being trans, the ways of being genderqueer are so broadly varied and depend on so many different factors. But the way we think, the way we see the world, and the way we translate that is very, very similar. And it is such a relief now to be living in a community of people who understand what I'm saying without me having to translate it all the time.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. All right, so thank you for coming to the mic. Being brave, love bravery here. Don't be scared, please. But yeah, please step to the mic and present and ask your question.
I just wanted to thank you first for sharing your stories. I guess my first question is, how does, if at all, the reader influence how you share your story? And, you know, does that have an influence on whether, how much information you share?
I'll start, and I don't want this to sound negative, but I don't think a whole lot about the reader when I write my work. I try to tell a story as honestly as I possibly can, and I try to tell it in a way that I, as a reader, would like to read. So I think if you start catering towards an audience and you start trying to write to specific audiences, you will reach a crossroads now and then where you have to decide, will this serve the narrative or will it serve the audience? And if you're really trying to serve the audience, then sometimes you can get away from what it is you're really trying to say. If you simply try to be honest, tell the story as truthfully as you possibly can, as faithfully to the events as you possibly can, it will find an audience.
I'm interested in your thoughts as nonfiction writers on the role between writing and living, and if you ever have difficulty like throwing yourself into experiences as you write, or do you ever feel kind of like you throw yourself into new experiences or justify old ones on the grounds that you can harvest from them some sort of literary or creative value?
I'll tell you a story. This is my little parable in answer to your question. So a friend of mine was a very famous poet. He was a poet laureate, and people asked, a young person asked him, so do you think that I need to suffer for my poetry? And my friend said, I wouldn't worry about it. Life will take care of it for you. So, Adam.
Yeah, on a more serious note, I will say that when I first came out as trans, discovering quite how violent the rhetoric against trans people was shocking for me, and some of the experiences I had were very distressing. And one of the ways that I managed to survive that is by going, okay, well, now I can write about it. Now I've got something that I can, that I've experienced personally, that gives me this emotional investment in going, okay, let's look at this. Why has it happened? What is this person thinking? What has led to them behaving in this way? And being able to kind of analyze it and research it and take it apart and then put it back together again on the page made it easier for me to absorb it without it just wrecking me. So yeah, it was very, actually very useful. Thank you for your question.
I'm gonna lower the mic. thank you all, this has been such a treat. My question is about your relationship with your editors and whether you chose different editors because of the memoir process, if that's different if you're doing nonfiction, you know, kind of more academic writing, but also because it's such a personal experience putting your life, you know, into these stories, what that relationship and that process was like with some of your editors in publishing these books.
Well, I don't know about your experience, but I was really shocked. Well, so I published with university presses for most of my career, but with this book, I went to a non-university press, and I was really surprised by, the whole process was shocking to me, you know, there's an agent, and the agent put the book out for auction. I didn't even know you do that. And in the process, you meet various editors, right, who's interested in the project. The thing that surprised me, aside from the process, was that I was shocked by how young all the editors were. I mean, like, under 30, like, really young. And I thought, and they were all wonderful, actually, but I also thought, my book is so much about aging. I really, you know, I didn't know, you know. Anyway, so I ended up going with someone who was, you know, she was the vice director of Knopf. She's being around. She's in her 70s. And I ended up going with Vicky, and she's so old-fashioned that she doesn't even use email. I send her manuscript, and she writes on them, and then sends it back to me. Then I have to call her and say, I can't read this word. my only thing about editors, I thought you have to make sure it's someone that understands your project and can sort of be there for you. I think the fact that they understand the project is the most important thing. And don't you think?
I think that is a very optimistic response. in the world where I come from, there's not a whole lot of choice between editors. You're lucky if someone wants to buy your book. And when the editor arrives, you embrace them and you get to work. So I didn't have a lot of editors to choose from. I was glad. My last book, I had over 20 rejections from editors. So I wasn't in the position to say, yeah, I don't think so. Whoever said yes was going to get my enthusiastic embrace.
Is that all right?
No,
just
yes,
jump in
please.
With one last story, just as a little hopeful story, and I can't believe this story even happened. But I had, and it goes back to the previous question as well about whether you write for an audience. I had not written for an audience. I felt that the idea of writing for a sort of general who I don't know who was intimidating for me, and I hadn't really gone down in there and got the stuff out that was very scary for me to reveal on the page. And we had sent the manuscript out, and I got about 20 rejections from editors. And while that process was happening, Roxane Gay announced that she was opening up an imprint. And I called my agent and said, I want you to pull the manuscript. I'm going to rewrite it one last time, which is not something that agents do. So she did, which was amazing. I spent 9 months rewriting it just for Roxane Gay. And I did that because I knew that Roxane would get it, and I knew that I felt safe with her, and I knew exactly who she was and how she thought, and so I could really reveal myself on the page to her. And it really was just an exercise in honing this manuscript that was too floppy at that stage. And it was finished, and my agent sent it off, and 2 weeks later, Roxane Gay called up and said she was buying the manuscript. So this does not happen for all, you know, as Gerald says, it's incredibly rare. But it also, sometimes if you're really tightly focused on a very specific outcome, you might actually be able to make that outcome happen.
Thank you.
Hi, my question is about something you addressed earlier about the fear of exposing your loved ones through your really vulnerable writing. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask if pre or post publication, what was your loved one's responses to your writing? And did that change how you did your writing or how you felt about it afterwards?
Well, I have to say that, you know, the readership question is related to this. I also didn't think about readers. Mostly I was writing, I was going through cancer and I didn't know if I was going to live. And I really just wanted to write letters for my kids and my husband. It was things I should have told them that I didn't, you know, in all this time. And so they were my audience. But I also have to say that one should always have some sense of audience, right? By which I mean whether you're giving a talk or telling a joke, you kind of have to have a sense of people, right? So it's not totally true that I wasn't aware of readers, but I was vaguely aware of, you know, making sure that what I'm writing is clear, that it makes sense, that it reveals whatever insights it's supposed to reveal. But what I did was I gave drafts of all the parts of the book in which my children and my husband appear to my husband and to my kids. And I was just like this for 2 weeks because I was terrified that they were going to come back and say, don't write about me, you know. What would I do then? I have no idea. But they came back and they were incredibly wonderful, and they were really supportive. And they said, oh, this is all about love, which my daughter said that. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But, you know, but the one person that's trickier is my mother, as mothers are. I mean, because my mother's the kind of person who, she's the kind of person who say, oh, my God, don't tell people you have cancer. She's a very, like, composed, socially conscious person. And but I also sort of just grit my teeth and sent her the manuscript anyway, at least the part that she's in, but she didn't read it. She has always said to me, I can't read your stuff, I don't read English, which is totally not true. She absolutely reads English. And for most of my life, I didn't care because I write academic books, and I don't expect any of my family to read my academic books. But this one, I thought she might read it because her pictures are in it, you know, but she didn't read it. But then I kind of took the easy way out and said to myself, well, I gave her a chance, and she didn't. Yeah. But yeah, with people really close to me, I gave them a heads. I showed them the manuscript before. Yeah.
I didn't show anybody the manuscript before I sent it out. And then when I'd finished it, I called up my parents who live in England, and they're, you know, as I said, they're very proper upper class English gents. And I said to my dad, okay, Dad, I've got to warn you, there is some sex in this book. So he said, okay. So I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a post-it on the front of the book with the page numbers where there's sex. So you can just skip them if you want, because nobody wants their parents to read about them having sex. So I sent this book to them with the page numbers, sex, and the page numbers on it. And I then got an email from him a couple of days later saying, okay, well, I've read all the sex parts and I'm fine with them. And now I'm going to...
Of course.
I'm like, okay, I guess that's how we're doing it now. But what is so funny is he was so horrified that I'd written about class that he didn't care about the sex. The sex, like, oh my God, you know, strap-ons, whatever. But the class, like, how could you have exposed us like this? Yeah, so you never quite know what's going to upset who. And my best friend, who I wrote about at length, she was just upset that I said her Hervé Léger dress was a rip-off. She said it wasn't a rip-off, it was real. I'm like, so sorry.
Yeah.
Same thing. When I write about my kids and my wife, often my wife has veto power over everything I write. She reads it, makes sure I'm not revealing something I shouldn't be. And I would never write anything about anyone close to me that I thought might be harmful to them. I just, as a rule, I won't do it. Even if it's a really good story, I won't do it. But again, you never know what someone might respond to. For my first book, I remember after sending it to my family, my sister called me and she said, how could you? And I said, well, what are you talking about? And she said, chapter 3, fourth paragraph, third line, you wrote, my sister Linda served fried catfish. You know I don't eat fried catfish. And that was it. That was her outrage. So you never know. You can try to be careful, but people will respond to seeing themselves on the page in strange ways.
Yeah. But you do have to sort of count on, use your own judgment because, you know, a truly loving portrait is a real one, right? I mean, I'm sure my mother would love it if I wrote a book about just simply how fabulous she was. But that would not be a true tribute to the complex person that she is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you for all persisting. It seems like you all Well, you are an academic writer, but you all persisted in getting your memoirs out, so thank you. I have a question for you, mainly, and you can answer too. How did you? You said you felt really bad about yourself, and you had to struggle to find a new identity. And it seems like you did, and you did it well. But the question is, how?
Well, it wasn't
a positive identity.
Yeah. Well, it's trial and error, and it's making mistakes. And sometimes you simply have to have really fortunate chance encounters. When I was struggling as a writer, trying to figure out how to write stories that were truly representative of African Americans and my own experience, it wasn't until I met one of my professors at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, who pointed out that I was not reading my community in a way that was true, that all of what I was writing were pretty much based on stereotypes. And they were negative, and they were not showing African Americans in a positive light. And he said, what you need to do is to write what's true. And I asked, well, what's true? And he said, you. And I really had to think about that. And what he meant, after months and months of reflection, was that for someone to go through a really difficult struggle and make it out the other side, that there had to be some really positive attributes that got them through it, and that I needed to focus more on those to tell a true story of what it is to be a minority in this country, or what it is to be anyone in this country. No one is absent of heroic qualities. And once you pay attention to the full range of someone's humanity, the bad parts, but the good parts as well, once you take into account the full being, you put the characters, if you're writing fiction, or you put the self, if you're writing personal narratives, into a position of having the opportunity for heroic deliverance. And I had to figure out what that meant in my literature as I had figured it out what it meant in my life. For me to get from point A to point B, there had to be some heroism that simply was not making it into my literature. But as far as being a person, making your way from one area of life to a better area, everyone in this room can no doubt tell stories of how they struggled and they fell, and they got up and they struggled and they fell and they got up, and that's just the process of living. The how is trying, and that's pretty much all I can say. But that, I appreciate the question to me, but I think anybody in this room can answer what it means to simply have resilience and to not give up.
Thank you. And you?
Well, I mean, for me, it everything that Gerald has just said, but in addition to the fact that when I was younger, I didn't know I was trans because I didn't know trans was a thing you could be. And it really was that simple. We just didn't have the language for it. And it was really only in the 2010s that the language started to happen and the visibility started to rise and people started talking about it and writing books about it, and trans figures were coming out in the media and on the televisions. And so it was in the 2010s, when I was already into my 40s, that I started seeing myself reflected out there. I started seeing the image of myself, and I was like, oh, that is what I am. And without that visibility out there of those other people, I would never have been able to recognize myself, because I knew there was something wrong. I knew there was something different about me, but it was like being in a pitch black room and groping your way and trying to find something that fits. I mean, I was a biker in my 20s because it was the only way I could figure out to manifest my masculinity. I bought a motorbike, cut my hair off, and I was kind of one of the boys, but I didn't understand at the time that what I was trying to do was be a boy. So, you know, that is why I think the visibility issue is so incredibly important when it comes to trans and queer voices, because if people can see themselves in... It's really hard to find your identity when you're trans or when you're genderqueer. It takes a lot of work, and you have to be very proactive about it. And if you can look to other people and say, am I a bit of this and am I a bit of that, and is it the way this person's doing or that person's doing it, it's easier to put those pieces together.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so, so sorry, but we have to cut the public Q&A because of time constraints. Okay.
I just wanted to know, what cult was that? And what do you think of the cult that's going on now with the election?
it's the cult... The cult was called the Worldwide Church of God, and its founder was a man by the name of Herbert W. Armstrong, and Donald Trump is its reincarnation.
All right, well, thank you, Gerald and Anna Oliver. Is there a sign? Okay, and downstairs there is a signing, so head downstairs for that. Grab a book. Thank you all for coming out. This was lovely. I appreciate all of you.